Hey, I really would like to do a little bit of a Bible study this morning. We could go really deep, we can go really wide. I'm not talking to you as someone who needs to hear this because you're captured by it, but someone who needs it to discern as you are in this world. So what we're going to be talking today about is called Battling Babylon. So let's just open up your Bibles, if you will. And if not, we've got an overhead. I think let's start with the first mention of Babel, or kind of the explanation of Babel as it's first introduced in the... a lot of you know this story, but most of us don't know the import and the implications that it has. Now, the whole world, verse 1 of chapter 11 of Genesis, now the whole world had one language and a common speech, a common tongue. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, which is Babylon, and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used the bricks instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we can make a name for ourselves. Likewise, we will be scattered over the face of the earth." So the Lord scattered them. Jump down to verse 8. So the Lord scattered them. The Lord didn't like that idea. In fact, the Lord said, "I am not going to allow them to build this ziggurat, this temple of worship, all the way to heaven." And it says he confused their language and their understanding. So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it is called Babel, which means in Hebrew, "because the Lord confused the language of the whole world." From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Now, a little background. What the Lord had told... So, chapter 11 is just a few chapters after the flood and Noah. And the Lord tells Noah basically what he told Adam and Eve. And we're going to look at that in just a second. But what he told them was to go across the face of the earth and multiply. But what they're doing right here is exactly opposite. They're unifying around themselves instead of obeying God. So that's kind of the main point I want you to get out of this. Now we're going to go all the way to the end of the book. Let's go to Revelation 17. And we've got a lot of figurative language, and it's a great curiosity to a lot of people, and I guess they miss the whole point often. Hopefully, we're not going to miss the point. Then one of the seven angels... Now, so a little background. We've got this apocalyptic book. That means... the word apocalyptic just means revelation. That's why it's called the Revelation. It's not Revelations. It's the Revelation. And it is the revelation of Jesus Christ. And it's a revealing of Him, and some of it has to do with the end of the age, but more often we're looking for the end of the age instead of the current age, and I think it speaks splendidly of the current age, whatever age that the church has found itself in. And the other thing about this, it's not just an apocalypse, it's a letter. He wrote a letter in the first three chapters. He's writing a letter. Jesus himself is dictating. In fact, it's the only place in the entire New Testament where we get the evidence that Jesus actually dictated word for word to his prophet what he wanted to say. Nowhere else does any claim like that is made in the New Testament text. Those were God-breathed, inspired, but they weren't dictated. But in this case, the Lord's giving very precise instructions. So this is a letter to seven churches, and chapter 17 is the continuation of this letter. He gives them real specific directions in the first few chapters about each church and mostly the problems they're embroiled with and the sins they're compromising with. So, Revelation 17, that's a little bit of the background, and you get a lot of drama. And so let's look at verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I'm going to show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on the earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names. And it had seven heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes, of the earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with the seven heads and the 10 horns that carried her. The beast you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction." Did you get that? Doesn't sound very dangerous for us, really. "And the dwellers on the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with understanding. These," the beast, the woman, the kings, I'm skipping down to verse 13, "are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. And they'll make war on the Lamb," and listen to all this drama, "and the Lamb will conquer them." It's all the prophet says. The Lamb will conquer them. The beast is conquered by the Lamb. Did you get that? "For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called the chosen and the faithful." That's the people in this room. "And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute, and they'll make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city and has dominion over the kings of the earth." Let's skip down to the next verse in chapter 18. "And after this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory, and he called out with a mighty voice, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living.' Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues.'" Okay. Wow, that's generally not something you hear in church every Sunday. And most of us are kind of freaked out by this bizarre picture that we're seeing of this woman riding a scarlet beast. She's got royal robes on. She's got a chalice in her hand. It's full of filth. It's just, think of sewage inside this chalice. And she's drinking it, and she's making the peoples drink it. And actually, in this, there's some of the verses we didn't get to. John the Revelator is being told exactly the waters are the multitude of people. And we're told who the beast is because we know he's some magnificent ruler. In fact, there's a whole series of magnificent rulers. And one of the things that's really important for you to understand about the book of Revelation is most people, when they read a book like the book of Revelation, they're reading it like they do a history. They're trying to find the sequence of events. And that's where we get into a lot of trouble. Because really, what instead of a pure literal reading of the Revelation, it winds us into knots of confusion if that's what we do. So this book is filled with allusions to the Old Testament. It's direct references to the Old Testament. And a lot of American Christians are not that familiar with the Old Testament. And they're not familiar at all with the concepts or the language. But almost every single verse in the book of Revelation has some sort of allusion back to the Old Testament. So that's really important. It's not sequential, but cyclical recapitulations of previous conflicts, judgments, bowls and trumpets and angels showing up. And it talks about how the beast and the serpent are judged. And then it talks about him being judged again. And then it's talking about him being judged again. And the next chapter, it's going to be talking about him being judged again. Because it's a recapitulation, basically saying all of these are gigantic systems. These are worldviews. These are the spirit of the power of the prince of the air. What we're talking about here is that everybody is looking to know who the beast is. The mark of the beast, right? We just skipped over a whole bunch of chapters, but how many of you have heard of the mark of the beast? And everybody wants to know what's the mark of the beast? It's on your forehead. It's on your hand. Well, I don't believe that's literal any more than Jesus is a tiny sheep. Is he? That's metaphorical language. And if you read it literally, you're going to get really stuck. And you know who the beast is? He tells us in that verse. He's one of the rulers. But then it says there's all this beast, and it's got 10 heads, and then those 7 heads, and then those 7 heads have 10 heads, and they just don't, they only last a little while, and then there's, and you kind of go through, well, was Caesar Augusta a beast? How many of you know that the Roman Empire in its day, 40% of the population were slaves? Sounds kind of like a beastly tyranny. It actually made Adolf Hitler's Third Reich not look quite so despicable, if you compared them side by side. Genocide was a public policy. And it is in nearly all beastly systems. Because we know these beasts represent mostly political systems. Let me explain this whole idea just so you can get. How many of you do any land navigation? Does anybody know what a topographical map is? Okay, I know you do. You're with Garmin. Garmin get you navigated to the place you need to go. Well, a topographical map shows you the contour of the earth, and it will put together lines, and those lines are demarcations of the elevational change at a certain latitude and longitude of the earth, and it creates these lines. So if I'm walking from here to there, one, I'm at the point here and the point there, there's a line here and there may be a line 10 feet up, and it's going to show that it's 3 feet higher. Why? Because about 10 feet 12 feet up, I would be 3 feet higher. I'm going up the hill. Or in reverse, I'm coming down the hill to the valley down here. Do you see it? But if I try to look for the line, I'm not going to find it. And that is what really a lot of biblical prophetic words are. They're symbols of a greater reality. Does that make sense? So if you take a topo map but you don't know how to read it, you may think you're getting ready to climb a hill when in fact you're going down because you're reading it in reverse. And when you see those little squiggles that look like V's, you don't realize those are where streams are, but you're walking down the stream instead of up the stream because you don't know that the peak of it is always the higher point, not the lower point. So, again, my whole point is you have to learn how to interpret these signals, these symbols. And there's a lot of symbology in here. So, let's go back to the Tower of Babel. Dr. Michael Heiser was the first guy I ever heard teach this. But his influence across academia is pretty pervasive. And one of the interesting ideas that's been, most of us have heard about the fall of man, right? What's the theological term? We call it Adam and Eve fell in the garden, right? We've heard that term. Does everybody know where I'm talking? Genesis chapter 3. That's the first fall. And that's the fall where what happened? Humankind made an allegiance with sin. They believed a lie and agreed with it. And that was the first fall. Now, notice I'm in chapter 11 of Genesis. The word Genesis means beginnings. And I want to just say this to you as parents and to you as believers. One of the reasons I believe the devil hates the first 11 books of the Bible is it exposes him utterly. And one of the least talked about chapters ever preached on in any church service is chapter 6 of Genesis. Does anybody know what that is? Most people don't know. It's where it says the sons of God came down and looked at the women of men and desired them and had relations with them. And it basically tells us that evidently they created a hybrid human race that was utterly evil. And you know what the consequence of that was? See, a lot of us go, how could God judge the world? Well, he's already done it once. It says that the very next chapter is about Noah. And there was not Noah and how many others made it? 7. 8 total. Noah and his family. The rest of the human population, God judged already. I'm not going to defend too much, but I will say this about God's judgment. Most of us, we're Americans. We like to be liked. And we don't like to deal with difficult subjects. But let me just say this. For God not to contradict his own character, he cannot tolerate that which is alien to his character in the universe, or the universe that is held together by him will implode. It will not consistently hold together. And that's why he judges it. That's why he has to do something about it. Otherwise, that would be the colossal calamity, of catastrophic calamity of human race. And you know how every one of us know that inside the deepest part of us, we agree with judgment? I'm going to say one word. I'm going to say two words. Dachau. Auschwitz. How about this one? Slave owner. How about this? Son of Sam. How many of you know that in the deepest... Why do you think all of us, even guiltily, like revenge movies? I mean, come on. Some of you are too pure to watch a revenge movie. But it's like, I hope he gets his. And when he does, everybody's cheering, right? Why? Because you're a terrible, no good, very bad person? No, because you have a sense of justice, and so does God. You can't have goodness if there is no such thing. There was someone that rebelled against him and introduced the opposite of his goodness. And that has permeated the entire race of human beings as well as angelic beings. Okay. So that second fall was pretty despicable. 2 Peter 2:4 refers to it. For God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. They haven't even been judged yet. And did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. The third fall was mankind's allegiance to himself. Ironically, the very next chapter in chapter 12 is about a calling of a man named Abram, from the land of the Chaldeans. Guess what? See, part of the problem, we don't always make the connections. Did you know that Chaldea is also just another name for Babylon, which is also another name for Assyria, which is also, in fact, what we're beginning to see is that these cities, these places, the first one originated was Babel. God confused the languages of the earth. Why? Because he knew when mankind became unified in its self-centeredness, it would self-destroy. And a lot of us, have read the book Age of Anxiety, we realize we're living in a time when we are very aware of the temporal nature of humanity as a whole just because of atomic bombs. And now, more recently, biological weaponry that could probably eliminate us all. And we have, if we get into too much agreement to kill each other and to kill us off, we could do it. See, this causes a massive anxiety, doesn't it? Does that sound like a beast to you? Does that sound like an elixir of putrid urine and sewage that the nations are drinking? Do you see that this woman is also a city? In fact, Nineveh, remember Nineveh, Jonah? Didn't want to go. He hated the Ninevites. Why? Because they were like Nazis, but meaner. And he didn't want to tell them good news. He wanted to tell them bad news. And then when he did finally, reluctantly, after being swallowed by a fish, he said, "Well, you got so many days, and you're going to be judged." And that evangelistic message worked, and from the king to the cattle, they repented. Okay, so that Nineveh was called Babylon. And guess who else was called Babylon? The prophets, Jeremiah, said Jerusalem had become like Babylon, and Jeremiah called Jerusalem a prostitute because she had betrayed. And we got a whole book called Hosea where the Lord tells Hosea the prophet to go marry a prostitute because just like that prostitute, I love this woman who's betrayed me. So are you beginning to see that we're not talking literally about a a woman of ill repute. And we're not talking about a city. We're talking about systems. We're talking about worldviews. We're talking about philosophies of this world. We're talking about the overarching spirit of the age. That's what we're talking about. And that's why it's so insidious, because it permeates the atmosphere. Okay? So, what's interesting, though, is in the very next chapter, we start the redoing of the entire story of humanity with one man named Abraham and his wife Sarah. And that starts in Genesis chapter 12. And the rest of Genesis ends with this family intact that almost fell apart. It almost blew apart. These 12 brothers, one of them tries to kill one of the younger brothers and sells him into slavery. And then they all become almost destitute. And it turns out the boy they put into slavery is the second in command and the king of the only place that they can go and escape to and live. And that's Egypt. And so Jacob and all his 11 sons go down and they meet their next to youngest brother, Joseph, who's now been promoted. And the very first time the word forgiveness is introduced in the Bible is after Jacob dies. His brothers come back and said, I know you, while Dad was alive, you were treating us pretty nice, but you know, we really treated you lousy. We're so sorry. He said, look, I've forgiven you. You meant it for evil. God meant it for good. You know what Genesis is? Genesis, that's exactly what's going to happen. We're all going to stand one day before Jesus and say, we mistreated you really badly. Our sins crucified you. But he's going to say, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And that is the story of humanity. And this is, so you go, okay, Steve, how's this? See, the question is, why did the prophet say, to my people, come out of her? And here's why. Let's get into it. Y'all still with me? Anybody need a question answered? I know you probably have some. I'm willing to take questions. That's why I invited you to come up here, doing a little Bible study. Here's the statement that the people building the Tower of Babel made for them. It's so obvious, especially when you study it in the Hebrew, but if you study it just in English, it's pretty amazing. The people in the plains of Shinar said, come, let us make a name for ourselves and let's go to a godless heaven. See, they were not trying to build a temple to get to God. They were trying to build a temple to make themselves God. It was the beginning of what we now call secular humanism. And what renaming always means is that's why parents have the authority to name their children, because they made those children with God. They have the authority to do it. So when we try to make a name for ourselves that God hadn't given us, we're trying to create ourselves in our own image. And one American philosopher said, when chance had sex with chaos, it created the evolution, airy man. What kind of life is that? There is no creator, and you're an accident. If that's your origin story, if that's your Genesis 1 through 11, can you see why catastrophic genocide doesn't matter any more than people living lives out in the country, because there is no right and wrong? And some of you are going, Steve, that sounds stupid. Yeah, I agree with you. But this is what Friedrich Nietzsche realized. He said, he's the guy that kind of coined the phrase, God's dead, right? And he was the philosopher that popularized that idea. And he was the son of a pastor. By the way, the word Antichrist is not found in the book of Revelation. No, you can't find it. The guy that does use it, though, is John, and he talks about it in 1st, 2nd John a lot. He talks about Antichrist, and you know where they originate from? The church. They were a part of you, but they rejected you. This is part of why I'm dealing with this. The spirit of Babylon, that city, what is it? The book of Proverbs, I say all young men should read it quite a bit, especially those chapters 4 through 8, and it talks about the wayward woman. And, of course, it is talking specifically about seductive women. Why that? Because, especially for adultery, but in any other case, why? Because it'll always get you in deep, deep trouble. And you betray the people you're supposed to be faithful to. You see, one of the most important things that we need to understand is this metaphor of Christ and the bride of Christ. Okay, all you guys, I'm going to talk to you. You got to put your wedding dress on. I know that feels a little uncomfortable. Hopefully it does feel uncomfortable. If it doesn't, we'll minister to you later. But the wedding dress is the bride of Christ. We're called the New Jerusalem. In the last two chapters of the book of Revelation, it talks about the New Jerusalem coming down from heaven like a bride adorned. So they're overlapping these metaphors. But what do you not want a bride to do? You don't want her oogling and ogling and looking at all the groomsmen. You want her, she should be focused on one man. We're the bride of Christ. In our personal daily lives, every time we commit a willful sin, fall number one, when we cooperate and participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness with the enemy, that's number two, second fall. And the third fall, when we just say, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to make myself into whatever. I can be whatever I want to be. No, you can't. That's the spirit of the age of Babylon. And you go, well, Steve, that's a doctrine of American culture. Welcome to Babylon in American culture. You know, are you telling me I don't have promise and potential? That's not what I'm saying. You have a purpose that God has for you. Your Creator has a purpose for you. Don't you dare tell your kids they can do whatever they want to do. Well, dream big. No. Dream God's dreams. God has a plan for your life. He knows the beginning from the end. He knows what's best for you. You discover that and you will thrive. Part of the reason I'm doing this talk is because it's Memorial Day. What I'm saying is eminently political. It's the most political talk. And here's the sad news. I'm not going to have time to finish today, all that I have. How much more time you want to take? One of the things that we notice in this text is the impurities. Do you know what an impurity is? It's not one thing. It's a mixture. See, the nature of impurity, a lot of us think about it in terms of sexual morality. And that term, and the reason the prophets of the Old Testament and the New Testament used that is because all of us get it if you're an adult, even if you're not married. You understand faithfulness and purity sexually. Every adult gets it. You get it almost without, okay, Steve, you've labored a point long enough. I get it. Right? That's why the prophets used that language, because that's the way God views us. We are His betrothed. And our undivided allegiance, I pledge allegiance to my God. I bow my knee, my fealty, my loyalty. This is what Christianity is about. It's not about, well, I believe in Jesus. No, I've renounced all the other gods. Why? Because there are other gods. Let's look at some of them. But before we do, I want to read this verse. First verse I ever memorized after I was a baby Christian. And I'm going to read it out of a translation that I did not memorize it from, but I think it's a better translation. Colossians 2:8. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy, empty deceit, according to human traditions, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. So, we could do a whole sermon just on that text, which I'd love to do at another time. But the problem with builders of Babels, they're looking for utopia. We live in a culture now where everybody wants... The idea is a utopia is an imaginary place that looks like perfection. It is a false replica of the original Eden. But it is a godless replica. It is an Eden without the God of Yahweh. And see, this is what mankind constantly is doing. And the problem is we have a whole Babylonian system pulling us toward that godlessness. And it's an attitude that permeates the atmosphere. And you go, well, I think this political party is less Babylonian than the other. Well, that's probably the smartest statement you could make about political parties. But you ought to say one more parenthetical after that sentence. But it has plenty of Babylonian spirit in it too. Do you know what happens to utopians? They always become dystopians. Man-made pursuit of godless utopia always leads to dystopia, which is a society characterized by human misery, squalor, oppression, disease, and violence. And I'm quoting now Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was in the Gulag Archipelago, his 1970 Nobel Prize winning story of what happened in the gulags of Siberia and Soviet Union. Tragically, I believe, describing the evolution of the prevailing Western view of the world, which was first born during the Renaissance and found its political expression from the period of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment became the basis for government and social science and could be defined as rationalistic humanism or humanistic autonomy apart from God, the proclaimed and enforced autonomy of man from any higher force than himself. It's man-centric rather than creator-centric, with man seen as the center of everything that exists. This new way of thinking, which had imposed on us its guidance, will never admit the existence of intrinsic evil in man, nor does it see any higher task than the attainment of happiness on earth. It's based modern Western civilization on the dangerous trend to worship man and man's material needs. Everything beyond physical well-being and the accumulation of material goods, all other human requirements and characteristics of a subtler and higher nature were left outside the arena of attention of state and social systems, as if human life did not have any superior sense to it. What provided access for evil, of which in our day there is a free and constant flow, mere freedom does not in the least solve all the problems of human life, and ironically adds to the number of new disasters. 200 or even 50 years ago, it would have seemed quite impossible. This speech, by the way, was given when I was a very young man. I was a junior in college, 1970s. In America, that an individual could be granted boundless freedom simply for the satisfaction of his instincts or whims. Subsequently, however, all such limitations have gradually discarded everywhere in the West. We've become completely unmoored by the moral heritage of the Christian centuries with their great reserves of mercy and sacrifice and duty and obligation. State systems are becoming increasingly and totally materialistic. The West has ended up enforcing excessive and absurd human rights, but man's sense of responsibility to God and obligation to society has grown dimmer and dimmer. And today we judge even our presidents by how much salary we made this year and the price of gasoline. And that's how we vote. That, my dear ones, makes you one of the merchants of the earth that were drunk. Please don't drink that. That is the least important issue. It is the Babylonian sea that we are swimming in every day. So human beings have attempted to create heaven on earth time and time again, and it always goes completely wrong. You have this great vision of paradise, a utopia. God's nowhere in this mix, of course. And once you've identified your vision of how you think the future could, should, and must look like, then you are now obligated to neutralize any threats to that vision, no matter the cost. That's how we get to the new values that speech equals violence, or can. That's how the most brutal regimes justify mass execution of those who disagree with them. Today's version of revolutionary are no less likely to implement the same enforcement policies, if not initially, then they will eventually. A mob of people without the scruples and moral center that there is a God to whom they are accountable can easily become maddening crowds of genocide. That's what happened in the French Revolution. That's what happened in Rwanda. Only a sense of accountability to a God who has created you and to whom you will give an account is sufficient to restrain this vomit of violence. When, on the other hand, an entire culture becomes inebriated with the wine of Babylon's abominations, like my creator is me, then almost anything goes. In other words, if I'm this self-created at best and a complete and utter accident by worst, the only meaning left in life is the life I now live in this very moment. If you therefore are cramping my self-actualization of that dream, then logically you must be eliminated. My justification for such violence will be your obtuse, haughty, and insistent demand that there is a greater truth, contradicting my fantasy, particularly any truth claim of exclusivity. Does that sound a little bit kind of like what's going on around us today? You know, you closed-minded Christians, you say Jesus is the only way. How dare you? I mean, that's you know, the Roman Empire was full of gods. In fact, you know what they called, in some instances, they called Christians? They called them atheists. And the reason they called them atheists was because they claimed that there was only one God, which is like virtually no gods. So they were almost atheists. And for them to say that all the gods that we kowtow to, then you're just judgmental and self-righteous. Does that sound familiar? But if there is only one original creator of the universe, which is what the original creator of the universe taught us originally, and we are wise enough and humble enough to accept that truth, then that truth claim is truth. There is no other truth. And so sometimes I will say that we've not always done it gently or humbly, and there's no reason to scream at people. The early church was very bold, but it didn't have the American economic, nor the American political, nor the American military. It didn't have any. It didn't have the American Bill of Rights. All they had was the Lord. We have some really great gifts, but we've got to make sure that we listen to this. This is Alexander Solzhenitsyn again. I've spent near 50 years working on the history of the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. In the process, I've read hundreds of books, collected hundreds of personal testimonies, and have already contributed 8 volumes of my own toward the effort of clearing away the rubble left by upheaval. But if I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of the ruinous revolution that slaughtered up to 60 million of our people, I could not put it more accurately than to repeat, men have forgotten God. That's why all this has happened. Now, there was a revolution in 1776. What was that revolution called? The American Revolution. In 1780s, roughly, I don't know the exact year, I think it was 84 or 5. There was another revolution in Europe. It was called the French Revolution. That's where the Jacobins began to have mass executions and the guillotine. We didn't have that. We had one guy was hung as a traitor, Patrick Henry, and he was hung by the British because he was a traitor. And, you know, and then there was another revolution. It was not as obvious originally that it was unjustified, because there was a very dictatorial czar in Russia, and the Bolsheviks were the working class, and they had been ignited by a couple of guys by the name of Lenin and Trotsky, and one of their young lieutenants was a guy by the name of Stalin, and they created the workers' paradise, and that became known as the Soviet Union. And that's where the 60 million. Then there was shortly thereafter, there was another revolution, but it was not one that was so obvious, but it was also in pursuit of an ideal, a purity. And that ideal was a guy who was he really loved Friedrich Nietzsche, and he believed that the strong and the powerful were the ones to rule. And his name was Adolf Hitler. He had studied Marxism and communism, and he really liked the way they organized things. He just didn't think there needed to be a party at all. It's better to have a dictator. And I'm simplifying for any of you history majors that will find massive gaps in my history here. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to talk about the spirit of the principality that rules the earth. Now, that revolution ended with at least 6 million Jews, countless others. Then there was another revolution, and it happened in ancient historical disunified China. And Mao Zedong started his revolution, his cultural revolution, somewhere around 135 million people lost their lives in the 20th century, the 1900s, all in pursuit of the Tower of Babel, man's utopian. And when you hear politicians that all they really talk about, and this is what frightens me. We've got to have value systems. We have to have a system that understands that for us to stand in the middle of the stream and proclaim that there is one God, and He loves us and He redeems us, but He will not forgive sin unless it's repented of. He won't, because you've got to agree with Him, because He's the boss. Did you notice? It says, they came to make war, and then it said Jesus showed up, the Lamb, and it was over. There was no war. Do you guys, how many of you, don't raise your hand. Some people had it as guilty pleasure, but it's really bad theology. The Left Behind series. I hope you didn't read it, but if you did, that's okay. But it's totally, it's garbage. But in it, there's this big battle called Armageddon. And the Bible, the book talks about this. But here's the thing. There's no battle. You see, when God shows up, there's no battle. It's a complete takeover. Do you know why God's not judging the earth yet? It's because it all stops. As C.S. Lewis, when the playwright walks onto the stage, the play is over. And He is the playwright. And so what we all want to be is we want to be the bride of Christ. We all want to be in the New Jerusalem. And we don't want to believe the sorcery and the propaganda. See, one of the things about her was she was into divination. We know that from the text. And the sorcery, her sorceries, they, you know what sorcery is? Sorcery is distorting something that looks evil, that is evil, to look something that looks good. The other part of sorcery is it takes something that looks, that is good, and makes it look evil. How many of you, every once in a while, watching the news, get confused? What's good and what's evil? That's why we really need to under. This is the purpose on this Memorial Day. This is really a political talk. Listen to everything people say. And what you're going to find is you're going to find mixtures. I'm going to give you a mixture right now, a good example of mixture. Black man killed by his, under arrest and is killed and suffocated under the care of his imprisoning police officers. A lot of people were upset by that, as they probably should have been. Another man is walking down the street in New York City. He's the chief executive of an insurance company, and a guy comes behind him and shoots him in the back and kills him 2 years ago. Now, interestingly enough, both of those two incidents polarized political parties and political movements. But here's a story. 35 to 40,000 Iranians were opposing their government, and they were killed in January, February of this year. Are you beginning to see? Okay, well, that's 40,000 lives versus one executive in New York and a guy who had a criminal record in Minnesota. So what's the big deal, Steve? What are you trying to get? What I'm trying to get you to see is there is a lot that we have to be careful about who we side with. And in a sense, we're never against anyone, but we're always on his side and his side alone. But we're always against evil. And so it takes a mine of wisdom. Did you remember that? That's how we're going to conclude this. You have to have a mind of wisdom, and you have to understand that the enemy has been practicing on human beings a lot longer than you've been born. And you've got to be careful how you invest emotionally, intellectually, materially in this world. And you need to make sure you don't get captured by that Babylonian prostitute, that city that wants to own you. Because every one of those cities and movements, they come and they go. Adolf Hitler's no longer here. Communist Russia's no longer here. Communist China is morphing. The shepherd's crook has come out. Let's all stand. I hope you got something out of it. Does anybody have a question? I'd like to, if somebody just says, Steve, you said something that really bothers me. I want to invite you to come and ask me. I don't know that I have an answer, but I'll try. Lord Jesus, we just pray for this flock of yours, this little emerging flock in the middle of Apex, North Carolina, one of the most prosperous places in the world, literally. And Lord, we don't want to be part of that consumer culture. The merchants of the earth that are drunk on gas prices and paychecks. Lord, I just pray that we would be a people free from being captured by this. Lord, that we would use the world and not let the world use us. you for your attention this morning. God bless you.